this weekend we are concluding a mini-series entitled Upside Down. It is a series preparing us for the Advent season. Other resources that we have beyond this room that you can take advantage of, if you did not receive one last week, is this calendar of devotions for Advent, which will begin a week from tomorrow, I believe. We also have the front of the worship folder, which says AdventConspiracy.org. And if you go to that website, what you'll find is an opportunity. You can actually print out one of the posters that is that, or you can just do this every day if you want to, and just go to that and have that readily available to you online. But you can print out a poster that we have outside in the foyer area that has a picture of an upside down Christmas tree on it with lots of different ornaments on it. And if you scan the QR code on each one of those ornaments for each day of Advent, it's going to give you an idea. It's going to give you a thought. It's going to give you a video. It's going to give you something that helps you, that helps your family think through and prepare our hearts for Christmas. And so, incredible opportunity there for us as we celebrate Advent season together. We are using this series to kind of base around loosely again this Advent conspiracy idea that was started back in 2006. Several pastors got together and thought, you know, how can we challenge our faith communities in ways to really worship fully and spend less in order that we could give more so that we can love all? And what would that really look like, right? And so we're in this series. And last week we started off by stating a few of the challenges that we face in 21st century Christianity, American style. We looked at the reality that really we tend to love with conditions, that we spend based on our desires. Now, we see no better picture of that than this whole weekend, right? Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Rest and Recover Sunday, I guess. I don't know what this is. Cyber Monday, right? And believe me, I've gotten caught up in it as well. It just gets so crazy, right? I remember several years ago, my brother had never done the Walmart thing like late at night or early in the morning or whatever. And so I'm like, come on, let's go do this. And he was hanging out with us at our house. And so he and his wife are like, okay, well, we'll do it. And they kind of begrudgingly went with me, you know, because really, honestly, I needed them to be in several different locations. There were several, you know what I'm saying, you know. And so it was total selfishness on my part. And so I get them there. It's early and it's before it starts on Thanksgiving. This was several years ago. It started at like, you know, something really that made more sense, like 4 o'clock in the morning. And so we're there and we're in line and we're going. And I'll never forget watching my brother, who was so not into it at the beginning. All of a sudden, it's like adrenaline. And he's like, and then I look over and I'm not kidding you. He's like wrestling this lady on top of this pallet for something. I don't even know. I mean, my brother's like 6'4" and he's like yanking on this stuff and everything. And we get finished and we get back in the car. And I kid you not, my brother and his wife turn to me and they're like, we got to get shirts made up next year. Like, what have I created? What in the world? And then to make matters worse, True story. In my family, my mom and my stepdad live in Knoxville, Tennessee. They were here in the service just about a month ago, right? Hanging out with us. She calls me on Thanksgiving Day and says, I'm going to Walmart to get a TV at 10 o'clock tonight. And I'm like, no, you can't do that. You're 72. You're going to break a hip. Don't do it. No offense to anybody who's 72. We spend based on our desires, right? We give when we think we can afford it. We worship when it's convenient. But as we looked into chapter 8 of Mark, we discovered that Jesus' love has no exclusions. That whether he was in the presence of those that the society were saying were going to make him and his followers unclean, such as the Gentiles who were out on the hillside there when he was feeding them miraculously, 4,000 strong plus, right? Or whether it was Jesus once again offering to the enemy, the Pharisees, the ones who would eventually have a role in crucifying our Savior, offering them one more opportunity again of himself, the enemy. We find that Jesus was loving all, no exclusions. We also saw that Christ challenged his disciples to not get caught up in what he described the yeast of the Pharisees or Herod. And we understood that that was this legalism, self-righteousness, pride, this preoccupation with our own issues and our own problems. But instead, last week we looked at the challenge we have is to see that we really can trust him and live each day with knowledge that he is in the boat. And when we really live our lives with the confidence that he will take care of us, it frees us up to be able to spend less so that we can give more. Which brings us really to this morning. It's the fuel that really makes all of those choices happen. It's our worship. Now, for Christ followers, for church attenders, we kind of get all kind of messed up about that word, right? Because we kind of think, well, worship is what happens when the worship leaders are here leading us in songs of worship in this moment that we call worship. And we even have a great time in here and we even use the words, that was a great worship experience. And so in our minds, what we see worship as is what's happening in this place, or maybe even outside of this place, but somehow attached to some music that's in our iPhone when we walk or in the car or in our house. Several years ago, we created this retreat for students that was entitled Worship is Life. It was built around a definition of worship that I believe is one of the best I've ever heard. It comes from a man named Louis Giglio, and he wrote this, worship is our response, both personal and corporate, to God for who he is and what he has done, expressed in and by the things we say and the way we live. In other words, worship is life. It is all that I am responding to all that he is. John Piper puts it this way. Worship is what we were created for. This is the final end of all existence, the worship of God. God created the universe so that it would display the worth of his glory. And he created us so that we would see this glory and reflect it by knowing and loving it with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. The church needs to build a common vision of what worship is and what she is gathering to do on Sunday morning and scattering to do on Monday morning. Worship is life. Worship is life. We've got these games here. And how many of you are board game aficionados? You like board games. Anybody? You like to play them with your family? I know it's almost getting lost to us now, right? Because we've got Call of Duty shoot 'em up games, right? But we love board games in our family. As a matter of fact, this is just a small collection of the ones we have. I know, we're really warped. We're really into, lately, this one right here called Doodle Dice. I highly recommend it. I'm getting no kickback from it, but it's just fun. It means nothing to this sermon other than to say we like it, and it has nothing to do with gambling. What I will tell you is, okay, let's do this. Let's see, you know, some of you, I know you're thinking, it's Sunday morning, you know, I'm just going to listen. I want you to be interactive because if, you know, okay, so let's do this. Let's do this little trivia thing. Okay, ready? Now, if you're a dad and you went on the father-son retreat, you cannot play. I'm sorry, because two of these questions were on a game that we played. Here we go. Which tokens were included in the original Monopoly game? None. Actual coins, pennies, dimes, etc. Rocking horse, lantern, purse, or top hat, thimble, and shoe. Okay, and I want you to think about it. 1, 2, 3, or 4. And I want you to get ready to put your hand in the air with the amount of fingers that you think the answer is. 1, 2, 3, or 4. Are you ready? Okay, ready? Okay, put your hand in the air. Here you go. Ready? Oh, I see it. Answer is none. None. I know. Isn't that crazy? It's like, I mean, how did they play that back then? It's like, okay, I'm going to be Lent. What? I don't know. All right. Okay. Number two. What was the original name for Scrabble? Crisscross words, upon my word, spelling for dummies, or scramble. All right. There we go. You got yours. You got yours on your fingers. You ready? Let me mark a set. Raise your hand up in the air. Here we go. Like you just don't care. And the answer is crisscross words. More of you got that one right. Very nice. Good job. All right. Last one. Question three, what board game allowed you to bump your opponents out of the game and send them back to base using marbles? Bump them, aggravation, losing my marbles, or mad marbles? One, two, three, or four. Raise your hands up in the air. Oh, I didn't fool hardly any of you on that one. Answer is aggravation. Aggravation. Does anybody still have that game, by the way? Really? You got it? Y'all play it every Friday? That is so cool. That is awesome. You're like, I have no idea what you're doing. Okay, so this game right here, Game of Life. Interesting game. You know, I'm not really into the games that are just luck games. You know, I want to think. I like Balderdash. I mean, it forces you to kind of think, right? This one says on it, where will your choices take you? But bottom line is, there's still a spinner and it's sending you to a space. I mean, it just is. And maybe I'm thinking too much on this deal, but it's just, you know, What space am I going to land on next? Lots of different things that we can learn from board games. I could play. I'll tell you what. Here's a great game right here. Baileropoly. 52. What? Overtime victory. But if you open this up and you. Y'all know me. And you think, wow, you know what I would really love to do is maybe own Health Camp in El Chico. I bet I'm going to win with those. They've been around for a long time, and they have spaces on the board. But if you didn't read the instructions of how to play this game, you're not going to win with El Chico. You're just not going to. Now, one of my favorite games that I probably have ever played in my life is Risk. Anybody like Risk in the room? You know what I'm talking about? I remember my youth pastor getting so angry one time playing with me. I've never seen him get so mad and sinful. He was like, I was just destroying him, and he got so mad at the game because I like moved his armies off the board for him, which apparently was like a no-no, and he just like slammed the board and all the armies, and he said, "Don't move my men!" And I was like, "I'm going home because now Jesus has left the room." But the because y'all are 9:30 and this is fun, right? If you play this game, if you ever play this game, and you think what you should do is just kind of fortify Europe and you're good, you are going down. You're going down because you've got a lot of places to try to protect, all right? And if you're going to have like a France mentality in this game, it ain't gonna work for you because the object of the game is world domination, all right? It just is. And so we can jump into a lot of these games and waste our time because we missed the object of the game. And we can spend our whole lives breathing in and exhaling air and miss the object of the game. The object of my life isn't to have a house that looks like Best Buy or to turn out kids who make more money than I do one day. It's not to save the planet, although God does expect us to be good stewards of what He's created for us. It's not even for us to just do really great things and be fine, upstanding citizens who will do more good than bad. Let's not say any of those things are bad things. They're just not the objective. Isaiah 26:8 says, "Your name and renown are the desires of our hearts." Romans 15:8, "For I tell you that Christ has become a servant of the Jews on behalf of God's truth." Don't miss this. It's not on the screen, so you'll have to listen. "So that the Gentiles, us, may what? May glorify God for His mercy." The goal of my life is to glorify Him. Our objective, boiled down into two words, is to worship God. And it's more than what happens in this room, and it's more than what happens in a song. It's the choices I make and the way that I live 24/7. So how do we do it? Well, Jesus was working with his disciples on this important objective as we close out Mark chapter 8, verse 27. Jesus went out with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the road he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, others Elijah, still others one of the prophets." "But you," he asked them again, "who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he strictly warned him to tell no one about him. So I've been here. I've been at this spot. It was several years ago. I was in the Holy Land. We're hanging out here about 25 miles north of Bethsaida, just at the foot of Mount Hermon. It's a location that's formerly the territory of Philip the Tetrarch, the son of Herod the Great. And they're like coming into this area of Caesarea Philippi. And this is a critically important location. Jesus knows what he's doing. Because as they're walking along, here's the history of the place they're in. There's a town there that used to be called Benias. It's also a word, Panias, which is a city where they believe the Greek god Pan, or the god of nature, was born. They worshipped Pan there, the Greeks did. The town that's there also is called Belinus because it was the center of the Canaanites for their worship of Baal, of Baal. Not only that, if you're hanging out there and the cliffs as Mount Hermon starts to go up and the foothills start to move higher up there on the cliff right above the disciples where they were hanging out, at that time you would have seen this big, huge, white marble display. This worshipped temple area that was built by Philip for Caesar in honor of the emperor of the world at the time, of the man that many regarded as a god, as they worshiped him. And so Jesus, he shows up here with the disciples, and it is location, location, location. Because Jesus is the master of teaching a lesson, and by using the surroundings to paint a picture that was even more vivid than the words that would come out of Jesus' mouth. It's in this location of Canaanite worship and Greek worship and Roman worship that Jesus forces them to make the call as to who he really is. Because he knew that if they were going to, and if we are going to, worship fully, then they were going to need to, and we are going to need to be able to define who he is. That's mission critical. Jesus eases them into the conversation by asking what others say about him. And they give some responses. They respond that some see him as a prophet, along the same lines as an Elijah or John the Baptist. But Jesus begins to fine-tune the conversation, and he asks them, "But who do you say that I am?" And when Peter answers this question, it literally splits the book of Mark in two. We're coming to the end of eight chapters. We're about to move into the last eight chapters. That's going to literally take us as a congregation up to Easter Sunday as we celebrate the resurrection and the end of the Gospel of Mark. But in this particular moment, more than just the fact there's eight chapters before and eight chapters after, Jesus gives, if those of you who are on college break are here right now for Thanksgiving, you know this term. He's basically giving them a midterm. And the remainder of the Gospel of Mark is Jesus defining through words and actions the title that Peter's about to give him. What does Peter say? Well, whether or not it's just Peter's thoughts or cumulatively he's being the spokesperson for all of the guys, he says this: "You are the Messiah." Matthew 16:16 expounds on this. Peter saying, "You are the Messiah, Son of the living God." He's saying, "You are the anointed one. Anointed one, translated Christ in the Greek, is the anointed one. The Messiah, the deliverer in Hebrew. Which, by the way, therefore explains with great clarity why it is that Jesus' last name really isn't Christ, as some in our society believe it is. So what's so special about being the anointed one? I mean, there were priests that were anointed ones and kings that were anointed ones. There were prophets who were declared anointed because they were anointed with oil and consecrated for a specific task. But Peter here is saying, I believe that you are the anointed one, Son of the living God. You are the Messiah. The one we've been looking for. And in this moment, if you want to go back to last week's passage, we find Peter's eyes being healed, part one. We see the healing begin to take place as his eyes begin to open to who Jesus is. But what is he really saying? And what does it really mean? Does he really understand what Jesus means when he speaks of himself in those terms? As we've already uncovered in the Gospel of Mark, the Jews did believe that they were God's chosen people, even after the 10 tribes were carried off by Assyria, even after Babylon destroys Jerusalem, even after the Jews are held in captivity by the Persians and the Greeks, and now the Romans lording over them. And even though they had not tasted freedom for a long, long time, they still believed that God would intervene. And that even if it was going to be by some supernatural means, the superhero would come on the scene to save the day. Matter of fact, this belief is also found in writings called the Apocalypses that were written between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And here's what we find about what Jews were believing would occur. Time up. That there would be chaos. That there would be a forerunner of the Messiah. That the Messiah would arrive and nations would come to fight him. And the nations would be destroyed by this supernatural, militaristic, nationalistic Messiah in a violent, destructive battle of all battles. And then Jerusalem would be renovated. Jews would return back. Palestine would be seen as the center of the entire world. And peace would come. And everyone would live in a new age of goodness forever and ever. Amen. With the superhero Messiah there lording over them as the victor. Political leader of all time. That's what they saw. Now, we don't know fully what was in Peter's brain when he said the words Messiah. But we do know that Jesus begins to define it for him in a moment. Probably because Peter had some different expectations about what Messiah would mean. But we do too, right? I mean, we see all types of messiahs in our mind when we look at Jesus. There's the laissez-faire Messiah. He's my Messiah, but the greatest thing about him is that he's really hands-off. I mean, he lets me do whatever I want to do. He's very accommodating. I mean, I really like the guy. A lesser than Messiah. He's a Messiah that is really incomplete without me. I mean, he needs me. He needs me to go on mission. He needs me to give. He needs me to do all those things. My Messiah is a needy Messiah. He is incomplete without me. My Messiah is an overbearing Messiah. He's a Messiah that is just looking for a reason to supernaturally smash me into the ground. As a matter of fact, wow, I guess I've been supernaturally grounded for a long, long time because I just keep getting into trouble. Well, my Messiah is a buddy Messiah. I mean, we hang out and we're friends and he's there whenever I need him. Well, my Messiah is a self-help Messiah. I mean, he's the Messiah that is one more option on the table for me to better myself so that I can be more like Oprah. maybe he's my free ride Messiah. He's the Messiah that's going to give me my free ticket to heaven. If he doesn't do anything else, he's going to give me my ticket to ride. And I'm good with that. And we don't even have time to get into the genie in a bottle Messiah or a lot of others that we could describe. Because we end up with all kinds of preconceived expectations about the Messiah. And our expectations are fueled by everything from our pride to our apathy to our fear. But if we are going to worship fully, we have to be able to define who he is. It is mission critical. And by the way, how he defines himself is the definition that we desperately need. So Jesus tells them not to say anything about the whole Messiah thing. Probably because he knows they don't get it yet and he's going to need to school them a little bit. He's going to need to fine tune what they think about him so that they could really truly see him for who he really is, the suffering servant Messiah. Mark 8:31, then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the scribes, be killed and rise after 3 days. So he's openly talking about this. And can you just imagine the disciples? They're thinking about this. They're listening to what he's saying. It's like, no, wait a minute. I mean, what about the big battle? What about you're sitting there on the throne and everybody's there. And it's like, and you're the winner. You're going to win the game by our objective. How can you win if you are on a cross? That seems so upside down. And Peter, kind of going way against his personality, speaks up. And he says, hold up, Jesus. I need a visit with you about this. And turning and looking at his disciples, Jesus rebukes Peter and says, get behind me, Satan. Now, if you go into Matthew, here's what's crazy. Talk about a funky, mixed up day, right? Or even funky, mixed up 10 minutes. At one point, Peter's like, you are the Messiah, Son of the living God. And Jesus is like, I'm going to build my church on that thought that you are expounding right there. Way to go, Peter. And the next moment, you're Satan. Peter's like, ah. Jesus recognizes that Satan is once again, just as in the desert, attempting to persuade him to take the easy way out. Side note here, sometimes the tempter speaks to us through the voice of a well-meaning friend. Sometimes God is calling us to sacrifice, to do the unpopular thing, to make a decision that will initially result in some type of loss or persecution or difficulty. And what you hear from voices that seem so well-meaning is, don't do that. Just play it safe. I lived 20 years in student ministry world where I would see students' hearts broken for mission. And their parents say, you know what? No, when you graduate, this is what you're going to do. No, the family needs you to do this. The challenge for us is to stay tied to our Heavenly Father and to the words of those who are also tied to Him and to His Holy Word. Allow those to be the ones that speak into our ears. Moving on. So he widens the scope of his challenge to include more than just the group of 12. You see that here in Mark 8:34. He summons the crowd. Now he's including anyone who might be considering the call to follow, right? And he says to them, if anyone wants to be my follower, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And in this one verse, we find that in order to worship him fully, we have to accept his honest, hard, humble invitation. Let's break it down. Take up his cross. This is an honest invitation here. No false pretenses, no bait and switch, no come check out the doorbuster special. Oh, well, we only got five of them. No. if there were other masters to choose from at the time, Jesus' immediate benefits package would not have been very competitive. By the way, I think we cheapen his call to take up our cross when we reduce it to describing our inconveniences and our irritations and our mitre burdens in this life as crosses we must bear. Because basically, the call to take up your cross was understood as, are you ready to be regarded as a criminal and to die? He was honest with the invitation. He must deny himself. That's hard. He was honest, and he was also speaking something that is hard. This goes against my selfish instincts and desires, my natural desire of ease and comfort and hang out in the recliner and just allow life to just kind of... This whole deny thing, it's more substantial than just I'm going to deny myself chocolates or caffeine or cigarettes for a week. It's bigger than that. It's me saying, I deny me. And I say yes to God as the pattern for my life. This is the Apostle Paul saying, no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And this invitation is hard. And he's being brutally honest with them. And it's also incredibly humble, because what does Jesus say here? He says, and follow me. He didn't ask his followers to do or to face anything that he was not prepared to do and face himself. Matter of fact, interesting, the word follow there in the Greek, we don't have a verb tense like this in the English language. Because what he's saying there is he's saying, I'm challenging you to follow me and to keep on following me. The reader would have understood it that way. And ultimately, what that would have been was following Jesus' example as a humble servant leader who gave of himself sacrificially, whatever that would mean for the disciples. And it meant different things for each of them. And if we're going to fully worship him, then defining who he is mission critical. And accepting his honest, hard, and humble invitation to deny ourselves and to take up our cross daily is a requirement. And I don't know about you, but our family's been having discussions about that this week, over the last several weeks, actually. And Holly and I are talking about that and what that means with our kids. And as we approach this season, what does that look like? Because our kids don't really, I don't know about you, but living where we live, our kids don't really understand that much about sacrifice and denial, because they can give and there's still more. They can give half their toys away and there's still some, you know? I mean, what does that really look like for our family? How do we do that? So I think about taking Shaylee to Belize and what that experience has been like for her, or hanging out in different places and being involved in missions locally. And what does that look like for our Christmas dinner table? What should that look like for us? What does that need to look like for literally under the tree for us and for the cousins who show up? And how do we give ourselves away? And how does that continue on through Christmas? And we're having this dialogue and I love it, because it's taking me to uncomfortable places. But somehow I think it's exactly where I need to be. If I'm really going to worship him fully, and as dad in the family, if I'm going to lead my family to worship him fully. Mark 8:35, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life because of me and the gospel will save it. For what does it benefit a man to gain the whole world yet lose his life? What can a man gain in exchange for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Lose his life because of me will find it. Screams upside down. What does it look like? You know, when we did the 10th anniversary celebration here several months ago, we had David and Karen here from Belize, and they were expressing to you their love for that country. And they didn't really get to go much into the testimony, I don't think, in any one of the services. But reality is they had a boat, and they loved to go sailing. And a part of that was snorkeling off of the and scuba diving off the coast of Belize, and God just kept moving them further and further inland every trip that they went, until eventually their heart was broken for what they saw beyond just the fun hangout consumerism of the beach. And eventually that love of sailing that he had moved his heart into a love for Belize that resulted in them selling everything and moving there, and now they are our point people there as we do mission in that country. I've got some friends from Lake Charles, Tad and Cindy. They had an oil company of sorts that they just sold. I mean, they didn't just wake up one day and just sell it. But what he did was, one day I'm like hanging out there as a disciple now leader for this church, and they were hosting these kids in their home, and it was great. And the next day he's like, I really love to fly, and it's so much fun. We've been flying into Mexico with my plane and taking Bibles to places in Mexico where they don't have Bibles. The desire to get the Word of God to places that did not have the Word of God started to seep in deeper and deeper into him, until eventually they sold the business, they sold their house, they sold everything. They're getting the gospel translated in languages where there is no language in Africa right now. And it started with a desire he had just to fly an airplane, right? And God meets us in all of these crazy places. And maybe it's not overseas. Maybe it's on Fridays I'm going to hang out at the Salvation Army with my kids. And we're going to give food and we're going to spend time. Maybe it's I'm going to give to the journey because I realize it's going to make more room for people here. And people gave just like I'm being challenged to now, so that my rear end could be sitting right here in this moment in time. And I'm going to be a perpetuation of that so that the gospel can come into every community in this area. I was just asking the question, what does God want to do with my money and my schedule, with my choices, with my January? I mean, this is going to be a time coming up in a month where we're just reevaluating again. What is our schedule like? What are we going to do with our time? What's going to occur there? And if worship is really more than what just happens in this room, then how are we going to worship God with the choices that we make across the 24-hour period of time in our lives and our kids' lives? How do I worship Him in every choice that I'm making? Are my choices pointing in His direction? Or are they pointing to some predetermined agenda that I have set for my life and for my kids? Will I invest more in worshiping and missional experiences and relationship building within my immediate family so that I will be the Deuteronomy 6 parent or grandparent that God has called me to be? And whether that involves hanging out at the camp with the video that we saw earlier, or whether it involves other things that we do relationally, I'm going to make sure that I am investing in the people that I say matter the most to me. And it is the calling of God on my life to be that spiritual parent who takes the time to mentor and invest in my own kids, because I recognize that's what matters for eternity. Rethinking about what and who I spend money on this holiday season, revisiting who I invite to Christmas dinner. Lots of different options here. A few final thoughts. Reading the how-to sheet really is important, because otherwise I think we do miss the whole objective of the game. And by the way, life is not like those games that I really don't like that I told you about. Life is not a game of luck. You and I make choices every day that impact the game for us and for those around us and for even those that we don't know. And one more crazy thought here. There really are winners and losers in this game. There are. Because I can tell you with 100% clarity in this room which of us will win and which of us will lose. Because what Jesus says in Mark chapter 8 is that I can't live for Christ and lose. But I also can't live for myself and win. It's upside down. If I'm not careful, I can think the game is supposed to be played loving with conditions and spending based on my desires and giving if I can afford it and worshiping when convenient, because really the trajectory of my life is more about my agenda. And crazy enough, my life begins to look more and more like the objective of this game. Because you know what the objective of this game is? To retire with the most money. Our society says the game of life that we live, the win, is to retire with the most money. And Jesus goes, whoa, wait a minute. You haven't even read the how to play, because it's about me. I want you to close your eyes for a minute. In worshiping fully, maybe it's just asking ourselves the question, am I responding to Him with all that I am? The King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. God, I realize spending less to be able to give more is going to be a choice that I make. But I can do that if my mindset is to wake up each day thinking I'm going to deny myself and take up the cross and follow hard after You. And God, I recognize as I do that, I will then live compelled to love all. How did God surprise you this morning with the Advent conspiracy? We're going to continue in our worship, and it will involve hopefully a very honest dialogue between you and God that will spill over into an honest dialogue between you and your spouse and your kids and your friends, just as it has in our family. God, may we see worship differently because we've encountered You this morning.